There's new guidance out on staff student complaints. We've had a big budget. OFS has been in court, and we ask if universities will close over coronavirus fears. It's all coming up.
Another piece of welcome news is getting rid of VAT on e-books and on magazines, newspapers, academic journals. This may not make a huge amount of difference to anybody's pocket, but I think it's extremely good news because it now means that copies of my own ebook available on Amazon are now going to be 20% cheaper.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Mark Leach and we have two brilliant guests this morning. Live from the top of the ball ring in Birmingham, it's Smita Jandar, Head of Education at Shakespeare Martineau. Smita, your highlight of the week, please.
So my highlight of the week so far has been a dinner at New College, Oxford, where Hugh Grant was nearly present. He wasn't, in fact, present, really? But the mere fact that he might have been was quite exciting.
And in Camberwell, it's Johnny Rich, Chief Executive of the Engineering Professors Council, amongst other things. Johnny, your highlight of the week, please.
Oh, probably it was going to the launch of TEDDY, which is the new engineering institution being set up in Canada Water, but that's not where they had their launch. They had their launch at the top of Tower Bridge, which is kind of cool.
And I was not invited.
No, you weren't. There's a reason for that.
Right, so yes, we start the week with a budget. This week, the Chancellor presented a budget full of funding promises, but light on policy detail. We're in line, I think, for significant additional spending of up to £22 billion a year by 2024-25 on research innovation. The sector was broadly pleased about that, of course. It takes us ever closer to the 2.4% spend of GDP by 2027. There's the £800 million for the proposed UK ARPA and funding for research in life sciences, mathematics, nuclear fusion and carbon capture. Johnny, what else stood out for you in the budget?
Well, a couple of things that didn't stand out because they weren't there was anything on tuition fees, which we weren't expecting at the moment. But hidden in there, I mean, what that means is that tuition fees in effect will continue to fall. If they're frozen, that's a real terms decline. And as Nick Hillman pointed out earlier in the week, that has a knock-on effect for research funding because there's a cross-subsidy from tuition to research. And so the £22 billion, you know, the cross-subsidy is a small fry compared to this. Very welcome, £22 billion. That is fantastic news. Long overdue. Still will put us probably below the middle of international averages of where we should be. Also, we have to take out of that the fact that we're quite possibly not going to be eligible for European funding. We've had about 900 million. So again, small fry compared to 22 billion, but it's not an insignificant amount of money. And there's a multiplier effect. The EPC has done research and we found that for engineering research, there was a multiplier effect of about 3 1/3 for every pound spent by Europe in terms of the access to facilities and access to international expertise and so on. So money that we weren't having to raise, but we were gaining that in terms of benefits. So that it looks it's around about £3 billion that we might lose in European funding for research. So all of these things do slightly dampen this extremely welcome news on research funding. On the loans, one thing that was sort of slipped into the red book, which your team noticed, Mark, and actually it's one of the few things I spotted from the red book, and I'm no expert, but they are proposing to end the sale of the loan book, which, given that they've been claiming that that's been a very good deal for the taxpayer, for them to suddenly stop doing it suggests that they didn't really think it was that good a deal anyway. And another piece of welcome news is getting rid of VAT on e-books and on magazines, newspapers, academic journals. This may not make a huge amount of difference to anybody's pocket, but I think it's extremely good news because it now means that copies of my own ebook available on Amazon are now going to be 20% cheaper. Well, actually, they probably won't. It probably means Amazon will take another 20% rather than me getting any more or it being any cheaper for anyone else.
Getting a plug-in for the book.
Oh, yeah. It's called The Human Script. Excellent book. Highly acclaimed.
I think what was quite interesting in the budget that was the funding that's been given to FE colleges and the sort of National Skills Fund. And the reason I think that's relevant to the conversation we're having is because I think it's sort of is an indication that all the rhetoric we've heard about how skills and vocational and technical education is the future is perhaps being seen by government as more the preserve of the colleges rather than universities. So that does rather worry me about where we might be going with tuition fees and the policy around, you know, what are sort of dubiously entitled low value courses, if they think that actually the solution to the skills gap doesn't sit in universities, it sits in colleges. So I think it is interesting to see how much, you know, money was allocated towards adult learning, vocational skills training in yesterday's budget, whilst the tuition fee position was kept, as you say, silent.
And it would be churlish not to welcome the money that's going into the education system at all levels. Actually, that brings us back to the research point, because of that $22 billion, it's not clear that much of that will go direct to universities. A lot of it, I suspect, will be redirected through industry and through direct funding. You know, Dominic Cummings having his hands on the decisions about ARPA and so on, and making very direct choices about putting it into specific projects that aren't necessarily going to involve universities in, certainly not on the traditional funding routes. And so whilst there's a huge amount of money, and this is very welcome, and a lot of it will come through universities, the bunting is still in the box, put it that way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that this wider sort of, you made the point there, Johnny, that wherever you fund education, it's a great thing, but this wider sense that you fund higher education or further education and not both is quite quite a challenging thing, I think, to get policymakers' heads around how they all link to each other. And if you focus exclusively on one rather than the other, you know, you only end up with the same problem we've got that's happened to FE over the last 10 years, where it's been ignored. So we've got to try and keep a balanced view on this.
Exactly. And I think that's kind of the fault line of a lot of the debates that are going to be happening over the next 6 months as we head into that second budget and possible government response to the Augur review, which kind of lays all of those kind of tensions bare, doesn't it? The other thing I want to talk about in the budget is the stuff related to coronavirus. Now, obviously, this, you know, the headline of the budget was about softening the potential economic blow that could arise from the pandemic. A lot of the measures targeted at businesses, some fairly common sense stuff about sick pay and the like. Not a lot that seemed to me that's going to help universities. If government advice over the next few weeks is that campuses have to close. I mean, already there are very serious economic problems that universities are going to face, in terms of international recruitment, and general confidence. I mean, you know, if we are about to enter a period of, you know, significant downturn, possibly a recession, possibly restrictions on people traveling, possible restrictions on campus openings, it feels like a bit of a chilly wind, and so far we've not yet heard from the Chancellor or anyone else how they're going to stop particularly some of the universities that depend very, very closely on kind of small shifts in recruitment, you know, how they'll protect them against those winds.
Yeah, I think that there will be audit committees rewriting their risk registers as we speak, and they're going bright red, frankly. There are some, the finances of higher education are so dependent on international students, and there's quite a lot in here in the budget that isn't going to help the international situation. And we, you know, we haven't mentioned the word Brexit yet, and which is also not helpful. And the new charges for NHS, for international students and for EU nationals, which are going up. The international picture for both students and staff is not looking good. Of course, COVID-19 is going to have a massive impact. It's happening at just the moment when the recruitment process is in train. And so I've no idea, and probably no one else has, exactly what the impact is going to be for next academic year. And it just could tip some institutions over the edge. And when it comes to bailing people out, the government is not going to have universities at the top of their list.
Obviously, as Johnny said, that's something that is going to be a massive concern to audit committees, to finance directors and so on about that. But even before we get to that point, there's going to be so many other strains on the systems that we have. So, for example, if we start thinking about things like closing campuses, I was involved in looking at a lot of student protection plans at the time of registration, and they're simply not going to be easy to invoke or clear as to what exactly the position for students will be if a university does have to close. And as we know, the OFS registered a load of people on student protection plans that it didn't really think were that robust. But unfortunately, they're now going to be tested possibly far sooner than anybody had realised. Student protection plans obviously had to link into business continuity plans. I know a lot of institutions are probably testing those plans now and trying to work out, you know, how robust they are. But again, it's one thing to have a business continuity plan that talks about how do I continue my business if my individual organization ends up not being able to work as normal for some reason. What happens if you take that across an entire sector, across an entire country, and everything is, you know, similarly affected, the things you might have relied on to do it? And I've seen quite a lot of interesting commentary as well about this sort of magic wand of shifting everything online. And again, I don't think really we've even got to the bottom of how feasible is that, given the state of technology, state of agreements with staff about things like lecture capture. Can you even capture a lecture if there's no one there to deliver it? We're getting into these kinds of, you know, really...
Assessment. How do you do, you know, online exams if you can't, you know, gather people together to do them in person?
Yes.
Seems like a really tricky
yes.
one.
Yes.
That also is going to apply to A-levels.
Yes.
If schools are having to close.
Yes.
And we're not going to have students sitting their exams in the summer, perhaps. I mean, we're a long way off that yet, so... It may not be worth worrying too much, but it is worth starting to make contingency plans about how we're going to admit next year's students.
Mary Kernock-Cook, friend of the show, of course, said that this year's cycle is going to be one big unconditional offer.
Are we moving to post-qualification admissions, you know, by force, force majeure, that we can't do anything else?
I think we might. And interesting on this closure point, I was really fascinated to see some lines in The Guardian this week, some vice chancellors pushing back at the idea that, if, you know, government advice says we, you know, campuses should be closed, that, you know, that's at all feasible or desirable. You know, not all students just live, you know, a 2-hour train ride from home. You know, they often live on campus. They might be estranged from their families. They might be international students. They can't get home. You know, they can't just be turfed out. And it's fascinating to see. It's clearly a bit of a row behind the scenes because I think universities are concerned that DfE guidance will sort of treat them as, you know, basically big schools. You know,
when you try and think, well, sort of what powers would they be relying on to order universities to shut rather than guidance to say, we think you should shut. We are in completely uncharted territory at that point from a legal perspective.
Well, there's
civil contingencies type stuff.
There's civil contingencies. But I mean, if you look back at the conditions of registration, you know, there's very kind of immediate stuff about not, you know, if you don't follow government advice, you know, that's going to be one of the red flags straight away. So, you know, there could be a regulatory intervention before it gets to gets higher up.
Regulatory intervention requires a sort of fairly lengthy process of suggesting what the breach of a condition has been, taking into account representations, deciding to take enforcement action, a challenge in the first tier tribunal that says, you know, this action was unjustified. So none of that actually gets the campus closed quickly. That's my point, that, you know, how are you actually, if that's the view of government, that they must close. And we are a very long way from thinking that they're going to go down that sort of draconian route. That's the bit that interests me, because the regulatory breaches, you'd have to take into account the mitigation and all the stuff you said then, Mark, about, you know, we had students that we couldn't send anywhere else. We had to keep them on campus. We did what we could. That's all got to be taken into account in deciding whether that red flag actually means you've been irresponsible or simply unable to implement the guidance in the way that DfE perhaps blithely expected you to.
Okay. Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi there, I'm Diana Beach, and I'm the current head of government affairs at the University of Warwick. This week, I've written for Wonky as part of its International Women's Day series to give a very warm welcome to our two new universities and science ministers. As a woman in HE policy myself, I'm absolutely delighted we finally have two women heading up these important roles. Yet I also recognise we still have a long way to go to ensure that theirs aren't the only female voices representing us around the policy-making table. That's why I'm asking everyone in UK higher education this week, If we're serious about shaping an inclusive future for the sector, then now is the time we let our women shine.
I'm Katie Aikerman, and I'm the Director of Quality and Standards for the University of Chichester. I've worked in higher education for over 20 years, and had always assumed that one day I'd be a Deputy Vice-Chancellor somewhere. Having arrived at a point where I'm ready for this, I discovered that, actually, I was missing a doctorate and or professorial title. I thought about undertaking a doctorate and then realised that whilst that might help me, it wouldn't help any other academic administrator in higher education. I got to talking with my work friend Emma about this and realised that the majority of administrators are women, and talented women, but without doctorates or professorial title. So as positive disruptors, we felt we should do something, and a blog for Wonky was written. I'd like to see the sector catch up with the 21st century and recognise that this administrator can.
Now, next up, the Office of Students has been in court. And while we're recording, a judicial review has been handed down. A decision on judicial review has been handed down. We're just getting this from the Royal Courts of Justice. This is the OFS versus Bloomsbury College, which was, I think, the first college to be granted a judicial review in a decision by OFS not to put them on the register, which is obviously a pretty critical thing for a provider. And it seems like the decision not to put them on has been declared lawful. I'll just read a quick statement being sent by the college. It's saying, in response to today's decision, we're of course very disappointed that the court has ruled the OFS decision was lawful. We sought a judicial review because the refusal to register discriminates against institutions that specialise in serving students from diverse backgrounds and lower income households who are all too often excluded from studying at degree level. We're absorbing this judgment and considering our appeal options. We will not be making any further statements at this time. So this is fascinating and possibly one of the first big tests of OFS and the register. And I guess it's sort of passed. But obviously, this is sort of the tip of an iceberg, I think, of quite a lot of pain and a very bumpy process that's got us there. Smita, can you just give us a bit of background to all of that?
Yes, of course. So the Higher Education and Research Act basically implemented a system where if providers wanted to be able to access certain benefits, they had to go onto the OFS register. And those benefits were obviously, you know, TIF or recruitment of international students and access to student support and degree awarding powers and things like that. So the OFS was the body that was charged with coming up with the framework through which this registration process would be carried out. And it set out various criteria that it would apply to providers who wished to be registered. Now, under the Act, in deciding what those criteria were, it had to have regard to various things, such as the need to improve the quality of education, but also to enhance competition and choice for students. So I guess what this judicial review was about was whether it had really got that balance right, because there have been certain providers who felt that they were unable to meet the criteria that the OFS had set because they didn't reflect the particular circumstances of those providers. As you've just said, in the case of Bloomsbury Institute, they feel that their student body comes from a particular set of backgrounds, which means those criteria cannot be fairly applied to them. And then the courts role is really not to sort of decide whether it thinks the OFS made the right or the wrong decision, but simply whether it operated within the parameters of the discretion that it was given through the Higher Education and Research Act to set all this up. So as long as in a way it was sort of operating within reasonable bounds and not completely irrationally, and it was following the published criteria that it had set, then that really makes it very hard for the court to intervene and quash decisions. It will say that was, you know, Parliament has decided the OFS is the right body to do this, and therefore, as long as the OFS is broadly operating within those parameters, we're not going to intervene. Now, obviously, I haven't seen the judgment, so I don't know if exactly what basis it was on, but generally in judicial review, that is the sort of test that the court will be applying.
So colleagues in the in a courtroom right now, where the judgment's being read out, and some interesting things. Obviously, a lot of it was about B3. So the judge backs the use of the metrics. It accepts all the OFS arguments about using them. Dismiss Bloomsbury's challenges on WP students in the context of about unfairness of graduate outcomes measures, and said that the B3 measure is neither irrational nor unfair nor arbitrary.
And it is very difficult through judicial review to challenge the substance of decisions, which really at its heart was what Bloomsbury probably were trying to do. They were trying to say, look, you've put this this criterion too high. You've set it at a level that's not appropriate. But, you know, as the judgment seems to be recognising, unless it was a completely irrational decision, and as long as there's some reasoning behind why it was reached, they're not really going to interfere with that. And I think the sector sort of needs to reflect on what that tells us about the fruitfulness of future challenges to some of what OFS might do that the sector doesn't
like. Absolutely, because I mean, there are a handful of colleges and providers that haven't yet made it onto the register and are in different stages of challenging the decision, because it is devastating, of course. I mean, it'd be very difficult to operate not on the OFS register.
I think it's especially difficult for Bloomsbury Institute to operate, because such a large proportion of their students were from disadvantaged backgrounds, or are from disadvantaged backgrounds, and so wouldn't be in a position to switch. The institution wouldn't be in a position to switch its model to a privately paid for one, especially easily. And this, if you ask me, I don't know the rights and wrongs of the case. I bow to the judgment of the judge. And this is obviously the right decision in law. OFS should take this away and go and examine their own consciences and see whether or not there is enough context taken into consideration. I don't want to see institutions with terrible retention rates and with poor outcomes and for students and low satisfaction and so on and so forth. But they do need to put it in context of who are the students and what are the opportunities being given to those students that they wouldn't have had otherwise and couldn't get elsewhere. And is this institution actually serving a purpose that has a right to be offered?
There's an interesting piece published by Nicola Dandridge, chief exec of OFS, this morning on One Key. Seemed to me to read like a bit of a shift in tone, and obviously no coincidence that it comes at the time of this judgment. I read it as I guess trying to be magnanimous in this victory, and saying that, you know, they have very much listened and learned from the complaints from the sector about tone, particularly, and that kind of I guess the rules of engagement.
I think that actually there will be more. A sharper form of challenge to some other decisions, though, Mark. So I think this one, which was about getting onto the register, there isn't a sort of set process for challenging it under the Act. Whereas once you're on the register, if they're then going to try and take action against you, you have this right to go to an administrative court called the First Tier Tribunal. And they are possibly more likely to be willing to look at some of the substance of what people are challenging. So I think, although it's important to learn from this case, and it would be great if the OFS did what Johnny had said and what Nicola's article suggests it's been willing to do, and there would be no need for future challenge. Those separate kind of challenges might just be a little bit more scrutiny decision.
What sorts of challenges are we talking about? These are providers already on the register.
So there are specific areas set out in the Act which can go to the First Tier Tribunal, and things like sort of deregistration, imposition of monetary penalties, those sorts of things. But they're specified in the Act, the precise areas that you could take to the First Tier Tribunal.
So I think that's going to be fascinating to see whether we see more JRs in light of this, or whether others who have these challenges in the pipeline are going to be put off. It looks from what's coming through to be fairly black and white decision. So as Smita says, I mean, it doesn't give a lot of grounds for challenging the registration process going forward, and I think that is significant. Now it's time for Yes, But Does It Correlate? Here to set this week's correlation question is One Key's associate editor, David Kernahan.
Welcome to Yes, But Does It Correlate? The podcast segment that gets things done. Are academic staff numbers in universities growing or shrinking, or largely staying the same? I've plotted data from the latest HESA staff release by institution. The question is whether there is a correlation between leavers and starters between 2017-18 and 2018-19. Or is something else happening?
Well, if I've understood the question, which I'm not sure I have, then I think my coin has come down as heads. So I'm going to say that that staff numbers are going up, but only very slightly.
Okay, and I'm going to go the opposite way, and I would have done that anyway. I think they're probably going down.
There is a strong correlation. R squared is 0.91. But the direction of the line shows that on average, more providers are growing their academic staff numbers rather than shedding staff. The graph itself is fascinating if you're interested in what's happening at your provider, and is on the podcast page of the website. I've only included providers that submit this data to HESA, because where the data doesn't exist, I've not plotted it.
And finally, the 1752 group, working with legal firm McAllister Oliveris, has published its guidance on handling cases of staff-student misconduct. Smita, what's going on here?
So this is a really interesting document that's been published that tries to address what's legally quite a tricky area, because it deals with allegations of sexual misconduct made by students against members of staff. And the reason that is a difficult area from a legal perspective is because very, very different legal frameworks apply to the relationship between the higher education institution and its staff, and its relationship with its students. And that has led to, you know, it's fair to say, challenges in how do you process allegations of sexual misconduct in those areas. But in the words of Johnny Nash, I would say that this particular piece of guidance leaves us with more questions than answers from a legal perspective. So the first thing it does, which is actually quite a sort of seismic shift, is to say that we should not be treating these complaints as a form of discipline. Now, discipline in an HEI is really the university taking action against either a member of staff or a student because it is in its interest institutionally to do so. You know, this person has breached some code of conduct and the university wants to take action. So what the 1752 group are saying is stop looking at it like that and start to see it almost like a civil action where the student is bringing a complaint against a member of staff. And therefore, the key players in this are no longer the HEI and what it wants to do, but the staff and students. And you just you create a system where they can present their evidence to an adjudicator and it's decided that way. So that's actually quite a big change in how you look at these cases. The second area where I think it's created quite a lot of difficulties, or potentially could create quite a lot of difficulties in, is the how they're proposing confidentiality ought to be approached. So they're saying that, you know, the outcomes of these cases, whether it's that a member of staff is being dismissed or a member of staff is being suspended or whatever it might be, or moved from their post, that should not be confidential. So that should just be something that's public or available to be discussed publicly by the complainant if they wish. Now, again, from a sort of operational management of an organisation point of view, that could become quite challenging. They're suggesting a sort of central register of cases and outcomes that's maintained, which creates all sorts of questions about data protection and security of that sort of information. And then, I mean, I could go on forever on this, so I will just confine myself to one more area, which is that once proceedings are initiated, they're proposing that they should not then be capable of being discontinued by the institution. The only person who can choose to discontinue them is the complainant. And again, you know, that having seen how these cases play out in the organisational context, that could be quite difficult because there may be all sorts of reasons why everybody else concludes that we shouldn't let this case carry on, but the complainant may not want to. And equally, they're saying that if you settle the proceedings, the complainant should be a party to that settlement agreement and capable of enforcing it. So this is kind of quite radical guidance that departs from quite a lot of things that traditionally the HEIs have done in dealing with these cases. And I think it's quite a nice branding proposition of describing this as guidance, when essentially it's from an activist group that wants to see sort of change in a very important area, but which means that the guidance kind of doesn't necessarily read like the sort of fairly neutral guidance that you're used to seeing being issued by you know, the likes of the OIA or the ECHR and so on. My worry is that if it becomes the kind of expected standard of how universities will deal with it, then very soon we are going to hit the sort of thorny legal issues that I have identified, which I feel the guidance just rather brushes away. It sort of says all those things are very difficult and make it hard to investigate these things, and therefore we just should ignore them and carry on investigating them in the way that we think is better. So I think we have to, there are bits of it that I think really do need to be looked at, but that's also true of reflected in things like the OFS consultation. But there are going to be some areas where I suspect we need further thinking before it could really be adopted.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to delve deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via iTunes or your favourite Android podcast directory. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to Johnny and Smita and everyone at Wonky HQ for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.